lithography and quantum film. And I'm reporting on work done with several friends, namely Vishnu Regula, Joan Simon, Jan de Boer. This latter is a paper that will come out soon, we hope, and also I briefly mentioned some work with Claire Krauss and Masaki Shigemori. Great. So let's see, three of the key problems in quantum gravity are to understand the nature of gravitational singularities, perhaps resolve them, to understand why and how the thermodynamic aspects of gravity emerge, why this, for example, horizons, why do they have an entropy and often a temperature, and to come to grips in some detailed way with the information loss problem or lack thereof. So what I'll try to do today is present a perspective on that and suggest that the way these issues are dealt with in general is that very heavy pure states in gravity appear mixed to almost all probes. Secondly, that the underlying pure microstates for a very heavy state form a sort of topologically complex foam. Thirdly, that the effective low energy description, which is what we give in gravity of such foam, is generally the usual singular geometries that we write down, often with horizons. And that finally, perhaps this is the general mechanism for the emergent thermodynamics of gravity. So, to try to convince you of these points, the plan of this talk is going to be in two steps. First, I'll talk about Schwarzschild black holes, because after all, that's what we really want to talk about most of the time. And there, I'll mostly be able to make arguments as opposed to rigorous calculations because of the lack of supersymmetry. And then I will revisit all these issues in the case of half CPS states where everything can be done exactly. So let's start with Schwarzschild black holes. I'm immediately going to put the black hole in a box, namely I'm going to put it in the world with a negative cosmological constant. So this is in string theory, so I'll consider in particular ADS5 plus S5. The reasons for doing this are twofold. First of all, in ADS space, black holes come into equilibrium with the radiation, so that's helpful to make them stable, and we can study a stable system. And secondly, there's a dual field theory, the N equals 4 SUN super Yang-Mills theory that we're all very familiar with. Let me remind you what the metric of such a black hole is. It's minus 1 plus R squared over L squared minus R naught squared over R squared. R naught tells you the mass of the system. That's dt squared, so it's the same thing, inverse dr squared plus the sphere. You can work out the mass of this black hole, and it's R naught squared over the five-dimensional Newton constant. And then if you convert that into the units of the dual CFT by taking the mass and multiplying by the ABS scale and crank through, you'll get that the answer is of order n squared, where n was the rank of the dual gauge group. Likewise, you find out that if you measure the entropy as the area of the horizon divided by the Newton constant, you find out that the entropy is also of order n squared. So if we were to read the ABS-CFT correspondence directly and say, you know, so what should this black hole correspond to in field theory? Very often, of course, you model black holes as thermal states, but you know, if you just read it as you're instructed to read it, then you would say that a microstate of the black hole should be related in the field theory to a state constructed by applying an operator with a conformal dimension of order n squared to the vacuum. So the microstate should look like that. So just to give you, these are actually extremely unfamiliar operators for those of us who actually play with gauge theories, and let me explain why. For starters, supergravity states, like little gravitons and things that float around in space-time, correspond to operators of a conformal dimension of order 1. These are the things we're most familiar with. They're things like trace x squared and things like that in n equals 4 Yang-Mills. String states in space-time have a conformal dimension g string n to the quarter. We have become somewhat familiar with that as a result of the work on PP waves by BMN and others. D-brain states in space-time, like, for example, giant gravitons and other kinds of things, have conformal dimensions of order n, and already when you're talking about operators with a conformal dimension of order n, many unfamiliar things happen. For example, the usual factorization of correlation functions that we're used to in large n gauge theories has to be treated more carefully when you talk about operators of such a large conformal dimension, because the conformal dimension is in fact growing with n, and so you have to be very careful about making statements involving factorization of correlation functions. So that's already a tricky thing. I'm just trying to emphasize that black hole microstates are dual enormous operators of a conformal dimension much larger than what we're used to, and these operators have properties that we are therefore somewhat unfamiliar with, and that's what I will try to draw out some more. So what's the structure of a microstate operator? Well, in Yang-Mills theory, the way you're supposed to make operators is you take the fields, the gauge fields, the fermions, and the three complex scalar fields. You can construct long polynomials out of this, sprinkle traces to make it engage in there, and chuck in some derivatives if you feel like it. And well, you get operators like this, you know, trace of some polynomial, trace of some polynomial, etc. So of course you can write operators like this, but immediately there are some caveats or some issues that arise about whether you can write the operators like this, particularly for operators of such large dimension. Well, the first thing is, of course, traces of terms that have more than n things in them can split up into smaller traces. That's true, and I'm going to ignore it because, as you will see, it'll be completely irrelevant to the kind of argument I'm going to make. We can work through that in detail if necessary, but it's going to be irrelevant, so I'll ignore it. The second thing is mixing. When you consider operators of such large dimension, suppose you write down your favorite sequence of traces, and I write down my favorite sequence of traces that happen to have the same charges, then in fact, we can expect that the generic pair of operators mix very strongly. There's no reason, because that's because of the failure of factorization for very large operators of this kind. But as you will also see, that mixing issue will be irrelevant to my argument. It doesn't matter. If it mixes, the argument gets better. So we'll come back to that later. A third issue is, well, I'm going to consider operators that, when I say conformal dimension n squared, that have many, many terms. So, well, one thing that we have to be careful about is, since there's no supersymmetry here for these operators, they could renormalize very strongly. And so it could be that an operator that was sort of smaller, if you like, had a lower conformal dimension in the free theory, grows to get larger conformal dimension in the interacting theory. That may be true. It still won't matter very much because you've got to start out with reasonably large operators to, in any case, for the thing to renormalize to be a black hole. But let me make a brief argument suggesting that perhaps operators of this large size, even if non-supersymmetric, do not renormalize very much, and then we'll move along. And this argument comes in three parts. First of all, note that the conformal dimension of order is n squared and doesn't have any Yang-Mills coupling dependence. That tells us that at strong coupling anyway, these operators don't have a dimension that renormalizes the coupling. Of course, it could still be that the dimension renormalizes from weak coupling to strong coupling. But there, we know famously that the free energy of the n equals 4 Yang-Mills, the thermal Yang-Mills theory, which is the usual way we model black holes, only renormalizes by a factor of 3/4 in going from weak coupling to strong coupling. So that suggests there's something sort of more or less stable about these operators. That sounds extremely weird because these are very heavy, highly non-supersymmetric states. How could it happen? And the basic mechanism that could be happening is that if you look at one of these, if you look at one of these things and imagine what you would do to compute the conformal dimension, well, you have many terms interacting with many terms in a random sort of way, and it could well be that because of the enormous size of such operators and their random structure, that you get as many positive as negative contributions, and they sort of more or less balance out to give an operator that does not renormalize very much. You'll see that suggestion makes some sense in a minute when I say something more about the structure of these operators. So for the moment, just because I don't want to write too many things on the board, on the transparency, for simplicity, I'll pretend that I can write down all of these operators as a single trace, we know they break up, which is a long polynomial in the scalar field, where of course I know we should put, and the argument does not change if you add in more traces, more fields, derivatives, etc. So the claim concerning the Schwarzschild black hole is, suppose you take one of these operators that I mentioned just now, with a conformal dimension of order n squared, and construct such a black hole microstate, and let OP, there should have been an OP here, let OP be any other operator you want that you want to treat as a probe. The computation that you can do in the field theory is compute correlation functions of the probe in the state that you make, and the claim is that this depends only on the conformal dimension and global charges of the state operator O and the probe operator OP up to exponentially small order e to the minus n squared corrections for almost all operators O and almost all probes OP. So why is this? Well, so let's go step by step. First of all, what do such operators O look like, these state operators? Well, almost all long strings, now let's think about these as single trace operators that is a long sequence in letters, and we'll build up details later, almost all such long strings are known to belong to a so-called typical set, which is characterized by the statistical randomness of the letters in such a polynomial. In particular, if you take the probability that a random letter equals the letter X, then that's simply equal to 1 over the alphabet, it's the uniform, you have a uniform distribution of the letters. And you can also talk about higher correlation functions if you want. Then there's a theorem in information theory called Sandow's theorem that says the following thing. Suppose you pick an operator which contains a particular distribution of letters that isn't the uniform distribution, and we ask the question, what is the likelihood of picking an operator that has a distribution, Q, of letters that deviates from the distribution P, which is the distribution of the typical state? And the answer is given by this formula, e to the minus delta, which is the conformal dimension, times a certain distance in the space of distributions. And since delta is of order n squared, we see that there are e to the minus n squared, order e to the minus n squared deviations. And the probability of deviation goes like e to the minus n squared, the deviation from typicality. Great, so those are two facts. And now, let's discuss what you do to compute correlation functions of this kind about which I'm making a claim. Well, let's see. Let's start in free field theory. You write down the operators and you start contrasting x with x dagger, x with x dagger, etc. It's evident that the planar diagrams are completely dominated by pattern matching, namely by the appearance of the probe as a little subword within the long word. Of course, there are many more ways, of course, of splitting up the probe and then contrasting the x's with different x daggers in different places. But each one of those, you know, gives you a certain contribution, and the number of times the contribution occurs depends purely on how often that pattern of contractions appears in this long word. So statistics, the statistics of the structure of the long probe controls everything up to the order e to the minus n squared deviations from this, from the typical distribution. And as a result, correlation functions are going to be essentially universal and depend on nothing except the charges that determine the statistics of the letters in the operator that makes up the word. Okay, and you can extend this kind of thinking and argue that this is true for all probes. It's not just true for small probes like a graviton, like trace XX. It's even true if you make a longer probe, like a string length probe, or a V-brain probe, or a black hole probe. In fact, a black hole probe is another polynomial, if you like, which is of length n squared. And that would produce a correlation function between two random polynomials, which will look random. Unless you, by luck, happen to choose as a probe precisely this microstate, which has made the state in the first place. Right? If you pick that one, then you will get an enormous response. So that tells you that while it's very difficult to figure out the state of the black hole, if you by luck happen to pick a probe that matches the microstate, you will know, because you will get an enormous response. Okay. So the basic claim here is that there are all of these underlying microstates, and it's evident that even if they're pure states, it's extremely difficult, essentially impossible, up to e to the minus entropy type corrections to extract that information. And let me point out that what's going on here is very unlike a thermal gas, because here, in a thermal gas, heavy probes, of course very energetic probes, pass through a thermal gas. They decouple from the thermal gas. That does not happen here, because very heavy probes interact all the more, because there are more terms to interact here and randomize all the more. So this is not behaving like a thermal gas, it's behaving like a system in gravity. So that's the argument for the Schwarzschild black hole, that it's clear that, you know, pure state, the effective description of a pure state will be as if, of a pure underlying microstate, will be as if it has sort of black hole-like behavior. So now I want to sort of do all the calculations, both in field theory and in gravity, exactly in a situation where I can control them, and that will be in the half-CPS situation, so hopefully you can build up more confidence that everything I said is in fact correct. Okay, so let's talk about half-CPS states. So I want to talk about half-CPS states of n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, so let me give you a quick review. Half-CPS states are 0p0 representations of the SF6R symmetry, and so you can think about them as polynomials in one of the complex scalar fields, and they will all have conformal dimension equal to R charge. You can construct these operators in the following ways. Construct a polynomial, and there are some upper indices I1 through IN. Permute the lower indices relative to the upper indices according to some Young tableau T, and then weighted for the appropriate, the plus ones, the minus ones, depending upon whether you anti-symmetrize or symmetrize. And that gives you, well, that gives you a gauge invariant state. And what's more, it gives you an orthonormal basis of gauge invariant state. So there was a nice paper, the Corley, Yavitsky, and Zambulam, that pointed this out. And there's a nice theory of isomorphisms between representations of UN and SN that is used here. To interpret such diagrams, one can show that, for example, a single long column is a single D-brain. For example, it's like a giant graviton. Two long columns are two D-brains, etc. And this identification of the columns as being like D-brains can be established with great precision. For example, if you insert defects into operators that are built in this way, you can show that the dynamics of the defect is like the dynamics of open strings with Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions, the realized Gauss's law. You can compute the spectrum and matches the spectrum expected of strings and D-brains. You can do this in complete and gory detail, but I won't do it here. Also, half CPS states can be identified with the excited states of N fermions in a harmonic potential. Why is this? So I'll just give you a very brief review again here, because this has been seen before, and this is work by, again, by Corley, Yavitsky, and Zambulam, and a nice paper by David Bernstein. So we're interested in states where the conformal dimension is equal to the R charge. So we have to use one scalar field, X. It must be in a zero mode, because if you have any derivatives, then derivatives acting on the field increase its conformal dimension, so that will break the relation delta equals J. You can only use X, not X bar, because, well, if you use X bar, then that reduces the conformal dimension. That reduces the R charge relative to the conformal dimension. There's an R X squared potential from the curvature coupling of the Yang-Mills theory. And if you put all of these ingredients together and crunch a little bit, it's fairly straightforward to show that you get a Hermitian matrix model, and that the physics of the half VPS states is encapsulated in such a Hermitian matrix model. And what's more, everyone here has learned at their mother's knee that a Hermitian matrix model can be reduced to a system of free fermions by first diagonalizing and then including the measure of the eigenvalues into the eigenvalues. Okay, so then let's think about N free fermions in a harmonic potential. The ground state is a filled Fermi C, and then excited states are like that. So we're going to parameterize these excited states in the following way. Take the uppermost state with energy En, and subtract N minus 1, call that delta N, and so on and so forth, to build a sequence of non-increasing integers. So any such sequence of integers can, of course, be encapsulated in the Young tableau. So I'm going to write that tableau T. Now, we also know that the state of such free fermions can be written down as a slated determinant of the appropriate wave functions, right, of the appropriate Hermite polynomials, which are the wave functions of these fermions. So there's a statement that the state created by making the operator OT that we earlier illustrated as being related to such a Young tableau is the same thing as a state created by this wave function. Okay? And then the conformal dimension of this operator is simply equal to the sum on the number of boxes in these rows. So the number of boxes in the Young tableau is precisely the conformal dimension of the operator. So we're going to use this extensively. So the way we're going to use this is following what I said for the Schwarzschild black hole. What I want to know is what the typical half CPS states look like. Great. Typical half VPS states, well, we need a conformal dimension of order n squared, and we want to ask what are the typical states. That's equivalent to the question of asking, what is the typical partition of delta into n integers? Now, if you think about this in terms of the free fermion problem, this is dead easy, couldn't get easier. So great, we can solve this problem, let's say, in the canonical ensemble. Let's fix the number of boxes in the tableau delta by using, you know, some Lagrange multiplier, and then we solve for some ensemble. And you can very easily show the expected number, that in the typical state, the number of columns that are there of length I has this distribution. So you expect e to the minus beta I, 1 minus e to the minus beta I, columns of length I, that acts like a photon gas. One thing that's sort of cute is that we started with a system of fermions, but somehow the statistics of the columns of the tableau act like a system of bosons. This is some kind of, we're familiar with bosonization in Fermi systems, but this is an interesting kind of bosonization that's happening on the statistics of the column. So if you fix the conformal dimension, namely the number of boxes, to be of order n squared, then the temperature, the inverse temperature, turns out to be of order 1 over n, and you can compute the variance, and there are fluctuations that are fairly small around the mean. the standard deviation to mean ratio is small. So then we want to study the semi-classical limit, because one of the main claims is we're going to say something about how these states look if you study them semi-classically, ignoring the details of all the quantumness that is going on in the state, and we want to describe this in gravity later. Well, the semi-classical limit for such a system is by taking obtained by sending h bar to zero, and as we send h bar to zero, we should send n to infinity in such a manner that n h bar is fixed. And you can work out the limit shape of this Young tableau in that situation. And if you make y a coordinate running this way and x running this way, this is the limit curve. E to the minus beta n minus x plus some constant that depends on n and beta times e to the minus beta y is equal to 1. And you can work out what this is for small x, that is down here, and it's linear, and work out what it is for large x, and it's logarithmic. Almost all states lie close to this limit curve. And in this sense, this limit state that actually follows, hugs the curve, captures the universal correlators, the universal correlation functions that you might compute in any half linear state of this high dimension up to small correction. Okay, so now what I want to know is how to map this into gravity. And I'm going to use the very nice work of Lin, Bloom, and Maldacena, which will be discussed tomorrow, I suppose. And for our purpose, we only need a certain set of facts. I'm going to recite them, and then I'm going to use them. So first of all, these solutions all look like complicated asymptotically ADS5 solutions. They have a radial coordinate y and some metric function mu of y, that u that depends on y. As y goes to zero, there is a plane parametrized by x1 and x2, which has a complex topological structure. And that structure is parametrized for the values of this function u on that plane, so on the x1, x2 plane. If the function u takes values 0 and 1, and we draw that here as blobs of 1s and 0s, etc., then you get a non-singular solution, a non-singular half-Lipschitz solution in gravity with the properties that, depending upon whether you're in the region where u is 0 or 1, one or another sphere in the geometry shrinks or grows. So the facts from this that we will use to map into the half-Lipschitz state are the following. Flux quantization of the fluxes in the gravity solution lead to the following identification. H bar in the Yang-Mills theory is related to the Planck scale in 10 dimensions. The energy in the Yang-Mills theory is related to the integral of x1 squared plus x2 squared in the special 2-plane multiplied by this function u. The number of fermions is related to the integral of u. So what this looks like, if you think about it, is that, well, the energy of a fermion in the harmonic potential is, of course, x squared plus t squared. So this looks just for all the world as the x1 is q, x2 is p, and u is the semi-classical fermion density in the simple harmonic oscillator phase space. So our job is to ask the question, can we compute the semi-classical fermion density for typical states, and what does that tell us about the geometry? Okay, so let me discuss that. The famous the distribution on phase space that people talk about is the Wigner distribution, and the way you do that, you compute that, is you compute the n particle density matrix, integrate out fermions 2 to n, and then Fourier transform the relative coordinate x minus y. The resulting quantity, called the Wigner distribution, computes for you the following thing. Suppose you give me a classical function, f of p and q, then integrating that against the Wigner density gives you the expectation value of the Weyl-ordered operator that corresponds to the function f. So if you work out the Wigner distribution for the nth simple harmonic oscillator eigenstate, what you get is this Laguerre polynomial, and so you get a wiggly function. There are several points that I'd like to note. This is not a ring localized at the correct classical value, as people tend to assume. Two, actually this need not even be positive. So it's hard to understand precisely how you'd map this kind of density function into the gravity setting that I mentioned earlier. What's more, it has rapid oscillations at the scale delta E of order h bar. So to take the semi-classical limit, certainly one thing we need to do is h bar to zero with n h bar fixed. And you can rapidly convince yourself that if you take a nice tableau, like the square tableau and things like that, or rectangular tableau that has lots of fermions stacked up with the same amount of excitation, then these things tend, in this limit, where h bar to 0 with n to infinity, to become nice rings with boundary values 0s and 1s, like we would have hoped for mapping into gravity. However, consider a state that, for example, is a triangular tableau like this. If you work out what happens for the Wigner distribution, you get rapid oscillations at an h bar scale at a level that's somewhat below 1. So the question is, what's going on here? And so, first of all, the first thing you've got to do to talk about this semi-classically is you've got to get rid of these oscillations at an h-bar scale, because semi-classical observables are not going to be sensitive to them anyway. The way we'll do that is by computing a different distribution. We'll just take the Wigner distribution and smear it by Gaussian of width h-bar. If you do that, you get a distribution called the Husseini distribution in the literature. And this is a distribution that computes the expectation values of normal ordered observables. And you can show that this becomes a nice ring localized more or less at the correct classical value. So you might now imagine a naive map into space-time by saying that each of these rings is mapped into a little ring in space-time with the correct boundary value to be non-singular. However, it's clear that even in the field theory, semi-classical observables, which are things like this, average over the h-bar scale. So we have to establish how to do that and then do the map of the gravity if we want to take seriously the fact that the gravity solutions are in a classical theory. So we should get the essentially classical or semi-classical observables. So I'm not going to work through the details since I'm running out of time. And instead I'll say that, well, let's suppose you pick a coarsening scale over which you wish to coarsen these distributions, either the Wigner distribution or these other Husseini distribution, and work out what the effective distribution is coarsened at a scale that's bigger than h bar, bigger in the sense that delta E of so okay, great. So now we have an observable. I'm going to map into gravity, and then we're done. So if you now wish to map this into gravity, this we follow what we said before, x1 and x2, these two coordinates in space-time, are related to p and q, the position and the momentum and position of the harmonic oscillator. The energy maps into the radial coordinates then, and then the proposal then is that this coarsened distribution, that is appropriate for semi-classical observables, maps into the distribution function u that determines every property of the solution. So we can work out what this does for a particular limit shape, and what you'll get is a grayscale distribution. Instead of zeros and ones, you will get a grayscale distribution. So, as I said, the typical states follow this curve, and if you work out what this gives you, since the values that u takes are not 0 and 1, you get a singular effective geometry describing the underlying smooth quantum state. I will finish with comments. So what have we shown? Well, various things. We've argued that you can get, we've demonstrated that you get singular effective geometry describing some sort of underlying smooth foam. Whether the foam looks quantum or classical, namely whether it looks like these nice rings that you got from the Husseini distribution, or a very quantum wiggly thing at the h-bar scale that you got from the Wigner distribution, depends on the observable. So you might have asked, you know, should you map the Wigner distribution or the Husseini distribution to space-time? So we would propose that, well, it depends upon which observable in gravity you wish to compute. And each of these things captures different aspects of different kinds of observables that may be relevant to a computation in quantum gravity. Thirdly, almost all probes give no information about the state, because, you know, they're only sensitive to this sort of grayscale distribution. And that, in principle, this could be something like a generic origin of the thermodynamic aspect of very heavy states and gravity. So let me end with three questions. One is, the immediate question to ask is, what is the relationship to the D1, D5 string and the proposals that Mathur has made in those cases? There is definitely a relation there, although our philosophy is not exactly the same. And with Masaki Shigemori and Sarah Krauss, you will try to demonstrate that in a similar way, the BTZ geometries and some of the black ring geometries emerge as effective description of various underlying states. Then you might ask, is there a relationship to the topological string and the melting crystal story, because there's a tableau that's melting here too? And that's an open question. And another interesting question is, while our states are singular because they have no horizon around them, and they have no horizon around them, because we don't have enough entropy, we know many cases now where alpha prime corrections lead to cloaking of such singularities. And does that happen here? It's an interesting question, because then we would see the effective emergence of a horizon out of effective dynamics at low energy from an underlying quantum state. That's it. Thank you.
Question. Gary.
So in any field theory, a typical high energy state will look thermal, approximately thermal to most probes. So the first part of your talk, you described the calculation in the field theory and talked about high energy state. And so I was very comfortable with the fact you were saying that you couldn't, you know, to see most of the details.
Yeah.
But then you made a comment that this was different from an ordinary thermal gas in its response to a heavy probe or a high energy probe or something. But you're in a field theory and you're just looking at typical high energy state. So how can it be different?
It's the large n-ness that's making the difference. So what you have is you have enormous numbers of fields n interacting. And the energy here is, well, the size of the operator, right? It's a conformal dimension. But you've got so many terms, right? And it's like going like n squared. But you've got n colors running around each loop. And so that makes it, that you make an operator, if you computed the naive temperature of the system, right? Thinking about this as a black hole, mm-hmm. and then computed the mass of the operator that you're using as a probe, and pick that mass to have be much higher than the thermal scale. This will still interact strongly because of the number of colors running around things. So that's what's going on. So it's a slightly different notion of energy. I mean, you've got a dense space. Usually, what's happening is that if you have a thermal scale, that tells you the typical scale of the width of structures. Spatial structures, and then the high energy probes very, very tiny, has very small frequency, so it just passes through without seeing this very long, slow variation in the background. But this is a different thing. Like, I didn't ever talk about the spatial variations in the field here.
Other questions?
Two questions, or one comment and one question. Firstly, the comment / question. If you counted states of Yang-Mills theory on S3, and you counted states at energies of order n squared, these states behave very, very much at 1,000 times n squared. These states behave very much like a thermal gas. That entropy is like a thermal gas. So I was wondering how that connected with your last remarks.
With what I just said.
Yes.
Well, so you know, we sincerely, in a sense, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we sincerely hope it behaves like that, because we know that the counting of states must go like that, because we know the black hole entropy goes like that too. So we need e to the n squared states. One thing that when I was talking about the Schwarzschild black hole that I didn't talk about, but which is I think relevant to both your comment and to Gary's comment, is the following. So, you know, if you take a neutron star and then crank up the Newton coupling, it will collapse to become a black hole. So the existence of horizons for states of a particular mass, I mean horizons bigger than the Planck scale, clearly depends on what the coupling is. So there has to be here some coupling constant dependent effects too. I'm reluctant to say the word phase transition, even though I realize you're the granddaddy of phase transitions now in this setting. But so I'm reluctant to say the word phase transition because I'm sort of not entirely clear about what I want to mean by that. Partly because I know the free energy just changes by a factor of 3/4 from weak to strong coupling. But there are some properties that may very well, I mean, the existence of a horizon of large size has something to do with the existence of, with the presence of a coupling constant. So I know what you're going after here is that you need to, is the comment I made earlier, that the thing looks like a black hole, even if the energy of the probe is very high, because the thing still interacts. And that's sort of not thermal gas-like behavior. But, you know, there's no contradiction between that and the number of states being the number of states of a thermal gas. Yeah.
So just as a follow-up, in large energy gauge theories, if you have energy densities large compared to n squared times lambda QCD, would you expect the typical state not to behave thermal?
If your energy density is large compared to n squared lambda q to d.
So it's asymptotically free gauge theory. At energy density is large compared to n squared lambda q to d to the right power.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I'll have to think a little bit about that. But, I mean, again, it's clear that at least in these computations, the high energy state in the sense of a probe of high conformal dimensions doesn't decouple. So there are two notions of energy to worry about here, of course. There's the conformal dimension, so to speak, of the state here, right? How big the operator is. And then there's the sort of spatial fluctuations you give to it. All the time when I'm doing these contractions, I'm ignoring the spatial variation. So if you think about the Yang-Mills theory as being, some spatially distributed thing, and you think about probes that have a fluctuation scale smaller than the typical, wavelength of fluctuation in the background, then that will decouple. But so for these kinds of computations, it doesn't.
So you're basically saying that thermodynamics is useless at large ends because thermodynamics, the typical high energy state is not well described by something in a thermal ensemble.
Well, that's not exactly what I said, because what I also said is that correlation functions are going to get universally described by certain typical states.
But not by the thermal state.
No, but that state, in effect, that's going to act thermal. So what's going to happen here, is that almost all states, right, are lying very close to a certain typical state. So construct your favorite ensemble. I don't care what it is. If you had any reasonable amount of your measure in your ensemble that's localized on the typical state, which you'll be forced to if you want to have any states at all, then you'll find that everything in your ensemble acts like this typical state. So up to e to the minus n squared corrections, it will act as if your calculations will give you the answers that are like as if you had averaged over all the states. But that's that's neither here nor there. This is a statement that the typical state looks like the ensemble. By the way, we shouldn't be so surprised, right? Because Boltzmann taught us this for gases. And partly what's going on here is the steady reduction of mysteries of black holes, the physics of gases, that has been happening in string theory now for 10 years.
Sorry, I'm sorry to go on, but one last question about a different part of your talk. You said that alpha prime corrections might help resolving the singularity in the black hole.
I didn't say that.
Okay. If you count the number of states in these half BPS states, they scale like n times a function of temperature.
Yeah.
Black holes have states that scale like n squared times a function of temperature.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that if corrections are relevant to resolving the singularity, they have to be G-string rather than alpha prime corrections, because they have to involve some power of n. Does that sound right?
Well, actually, let's be careful with that. So in all the cases in which there's been this cloaking effect, the entropy has gone as e to the n, right? I mean, it's gone as not... The reason why half BPS states don't have a horizon to start with is because the number of states that you have in here, for example, goes like e to the n, not e to the n squared. That's why, in a sense, you're not able to get a classical horizon. So now, so then it's a question of, in order to get a finite-sized horizon, you're saying that you need G-string corrections, basically, because you need the n to get corrected to n squared. But isn't there an issue like this anyway in all the cases where people have looked at BPS states picking up horizons? So in those cases, why did it work out that the alpha time corrections gave a finite-sized horizon? Yeah. So by the way, getting a finite-sized horizon does not resolve a singularity, right? There's still a singularity in there. It's just behind the horizon. Two different things, yeah. Oh, very good.
Amanda?
Amanda has a very nice comment that's useful. She says that sometimes the alpha prime corrections get factors of n in front of them for other reasons, and then they can be large. Okay, that can help deal with that.
Okay, maybe let's thank all of the speakers from the morning session.